meeting to order, and as I understand that we do have a quorum, we'd like to have the approval of the March 15th minute.
I'll move.
Any discussion? Gary? What? All in favor? Gary? I think we'll have Representative Jackson with House File 1712. You ready? Welcome to committee. Representative Jackson, I'll move your bill number 1712, and if you would like to proceed.
Thank you. Committee members, thank you for this opportunity to be heard. I'm here with my constituent, Irene Wong, and she will be 92 years old, right around opening fishing, and she'll tell you a little more about herself and her her interest in being an angler, you'll see one of the photos being passed around. She's caught some incredible fish on Mille Lacs Lake, and she can tell her own story.
I'm Irene.
Welcome to committee, Irene. Yes.
I'm Irene Long, and my birthday will be, I'll be 92 on May 11th. That's the opening of fishing season this year. Usually my birthday falls on Mother's Day or other days, but this year it's falling on fishing season. And I live in the Isle View Apartments. I've lived in on Mille Lacs Lake all my life except 8 years that I was at, I worked at Atwater. And then, but I've been able to go fishing ever since I moved into the Isle View Apartments. That's in, I've been fishing for 9 years now with Gene Miller. He's our postmaster at the post office. And he has been taking out grandmas, but I'm trying to get so that the grandmas won't have to pay fishing license, pay for their fishing license, because it's too big of an enjoyment to be out on that lake. I never could go fishing when I lived on the farm by Mille Lacs, because we had too much work to do. So now, since I moved into the Isle View apartment, I'm turned and I went to Gene Miller. He had said something about maybe he'd take grandmas out on fishing. So I confronted him in 2000 and I said, "Gene, can you take us fishing? How about taking the grandmas out fishing?" Well, he said, "I'll have to think about it." And he thought it over, and then he asked a few grandmas, and they were willing to go, but like me, we were fixed on a fixed income, and we couldn't afford the license, so a lot of them couldn't go fishing. They had to just give it up. I did buy my license, so I got to go fishing. And he had quite a discussion on that, so he's been taking me fishing ever since 2000. And I, on the first fishing season I went, I caught a 28.5-inch walleye, and it was 1/2 inch under the, where we'd have to throw him back. So I got to keep him, and he ate, and I ate him, and it was real good. And then the next year I went fishing, well, then I caught three fish in 2 hours, and one was a northern 42 inches long, and a muskie 43 inches long, and another one 38 inches long. Well, then each year I usually tried to go about 3 times because I couldn't go any more, because a lot of times I just bought the license for the day and I couldn't go. So then along came the 2 years ago, along came that great big muskie. I went fishing that year, and I had my license and went out with Gene, and we were out there fishing and trying to fish and couldn't catch a thing. So I said to Gene, I says, "Oh, why can't we catch just a 5-inch one so we can say we don't have to go home skunked?" And when we got in about 5 minutes or so, Gene said, hollered at me, he says, "Irene, there's a bite on your line." And he says, "You better get busy." Because our motto, Gene's motto, was that we had to wheel a man to the boat if it was going to be our fish, because there was always usually about 6 of us mothers that went fishing at the same time. So I got to wheeling, and I could hardly move that line, but I finally got it up to the boat, but I was couldn't hardly move my arm for 3 days afterwards. And then the worst part was for Gene and his helper. He always had a helper along, and they could hardly get that fish into the boat. And it was 54 inches long. And a big one, because I couldn't get my arms around him. And I had to hold him in order to take pictures, and he flopped, and he threw my glasses off the... I thought they were going in the water, but they landed in the boat. And he slopped blood all over. I was one mess. And I just enjoyed catching him, but I sure had quite a time trying to get a picture taken with him. And that's what Gene has taken me fishing every year. Last year I went fishing, Jason Davis came up, and he was going to put me on the program, and I think he still is. Still will be on the program on May 3rd, is what he said. But we couldn't catch any big fish, so he's using the big fish that I caught the year before for the pictures. But I'm still hoping that we can get the seniors so that they don't have to have a fishing license to go fishing on Mille Lacs, because it's such beautiful time out there on Mille Lacs, because the sunset is beautiful in the evening, and the birds in the air, and we can even watch the fish under the water. And it's really a joy to be out there on the lake. Even if you don't catch one, it's a joy just to be out there. But if you can't buy the license, then you're sunk. You can't go fishing. So I'm hoping that we're going to be able to get the, so that the seniors don't have to have a license, so they can enjoy the what's left of their life to go fishing on the lake. Because Gene usually takes out one day, and he takes out six people in the morning, six at noon, and six in the evening. So they all get a chance to go fishing. But now this last year, I guess it was because nobody could buy the license. When I went, there was only two of us. And the next morning, there was only two again. So,
I just wanted to share, because Irene said I could, that Representative Jackson, thank you. Irene lives on a fixed income of barely over $450 a month, and there are a lot of seniors in the area just like her who love to fish and could get out there a whole lot more, but for the cost of the fishing license. And I have heard from the DNR that last year there were 937 licenses issued to people 90 years of age and over. So I imagine that, you know, that does generate fees. I calculated somewhere between $9,000 and $16,000. But I would say that the joy that Irene gets out of it and a lot of other grandmas like her is worth every dime. Anything else you want to tell them about?
I think that we need to get so that the seniors can go. I enjoy it every year, even if I don't catch the fish. I just enjoy being out there, and I got my line in the water so that I can try and catch one, and I have caught except this last year. I have caught a fish ever since. I've been going with Dean now for 9 years, and I've always made him fudge. And I take fudge to my doctors and to my dentist and my eye doctor. They all get fudge when I go to them.
Well, Mrs. Long, this has been wonderful. And it sounds like there may be a lot of people lining up to have you go with them, because your success rate is better than, well, many other folks. Never mind the fudge, yeah. But at any rate, we certainly appreciate hearing about how much enjoyment and also the good fortune that you've had in your excursions onto the lake. I wonder if there was anyone else that wanted to testify at this time? If not, Representative Jackson, do you have any closing comments?
I would just like to thank Irene and her family for taking the long trip down here from Isle, Minnesota. It's been a pleasure just spending time with her, and I felt that she was a compelling enough example of what I hope to be one day that I even named the bill after her as the Irene Long Act.
Yeah, I got a question.
Representative Gill.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Jackson, for bringing this bill forward. I love it. Great bill. And I just wanted to ask Ms. Long, you know, we've got a lot of muskies in Crane Lake. You must have caught this in Crane Lake. Could you get that on the record so we can have some advertising material?
No.
You're just right up there with Ron Chera when it comes to advertising.
That muskie has been in the Muskie magazine, in the Fun Guide, and to tell you the truth, it's out of wall way out in Pennsylvania. They have put my picture up and my writing, or the writing that was under the picture, and somebody was back there from Minnesota, and they looked at the picture on the wall. They said, "Oh my goodness, is that picture way out here?" And it was in Pennsylvania.
So where did you catch it?
Well, Representative Jackson, I thought this was Game, Fish, and Forestry, but apparently it's the tourism department. Representative Purcell.
If I may, I just might offer that perhaps Irene might be willing to teach some young whippersnappers like Representative Bill if I catch those muskies. I don't know.
Don't bring the fudge.
Are there any further questions or comments on this bill? If not, Representative Jackson renews her motion that this
your motion?
My motion, I'm sorry. This bill be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. Welcome to committee. Representative Newton, would you like to, well, I guess I'll move your bill for you. I will move your bill 1848 for possible inclusion in the omnibus payments bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have a fish story and I don't have fun, but I do have David Olson, and David is a constituent who likes to spearfish, and he asked me to bring this bill forward, so I'd like to have David talk to the bill.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Dave Olson. I currently live in Coon Rapids. I'm one of Jerry's constituents. I asked Jerry to bring this bill forward. And the reason why I asked it is I have a stake in the fishing and the hunting in this state. I currently possess a lifetime deer hunting license and a lifetime small game combination license, which allows me to take small game and fish. There is no provision within state law for a lifetime spearing license. My concern would be is that if at some point in time it became a non-resident and I wanted to come back and spear, I could not because there is no provisions in Minnesota for non-resident spearing licenses. And that's why I asked for it to go forward with that is, while I may be a resident all my life, there are people that do hold lifetime licenses that are not residents of Minnesota and cannot come back and spear. And I don't know what else to do about it. I certainly don't want to be out taking fish illegally. Game warden would kind of frown upon that a little bit.
And Madam Chair, this is for what you call dark elk spearing.
Are there any questions of the testifier? Is there anyone else that would like to present some testimony on this bill? Any other comments? If not, Representative Newton, would you have some final comments you have?
Well, I just want to thank you for listening to the bill, and this goes a lot smoother than K-12 education.
Stick around.
Maybe it's so prematurely.
Representative Dill.
Have you considered what the cost, do you know what the cost increase would be to add this into the lifetime licenses? And how much more would a lifetime license cost if this were added in?
I believe
we have that here somewhere. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just got here, so I'm telling you.
It's on the second page, Representative Dill, Madam Chair. It's on the second page, section 4, lines 218. And I spoke just before giving testimony with, I think, the Assistant Commissioner for Game and Wildlife, and they would like to look at this and ask us to consider amending it to make sure that it doesn't mean for everyone who has a lifetime license that they have to pay the rates for people who will be spearfishing as well.
I'd like to add, spearfishing within the dark house is a very small segment of the people that take fish in this state. I'm guessing that not over 5% of the people that fish spearfish. It is really narrowly defined. It's kind of narrowly defined because really the best time to fish by spearing is when you only have about a foot to 18 inches ice. Once you get past the 2 feet, 3 feet, spearing is almost impossible. So it's only for the first month and a half of ice, and then it's basically over with.
Representative Dill.
I agree with you, it's a very small percentage of the fishing population, but the northern pike harvest is around 22 or 23% of the total northern pike harvest statewide, meaning open water and angling.
Okay.
Or spearing. So, I mean, a small number of people take a lot of fish as a percentage. But
you would be considering that. You'd be considering that 23% to be by hook and line and also by spearing goal. So the people that would be taking it by hook and line, they'd get their take regardless. So you'd have to kind of narrow that down to the 5% as to what they're taking by dark house spearing.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Dill.
That is what the dark house spearers are taking. Of the total northern pike harvest statewide in a year, 22% is taken by spearing.
Okay.
Yeah. And that has nothing to do with the fee or a lifetime license, but when you said 5% of the people spear or less, they do still take a sizable portion of the northern pike harvest, even though it's a small number. Maybe Representative Hagbart knows the exact number. I recall that from the last bill hearing we had, was it was 22%. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Hagbart. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to comment, too, and I'm sure the author and your constituents isn't aware of the fact that we did have another bill that is going to possibly create a non-resident spearing license. And if that's part of the concern and the reason that we're bringing this bill forward, that's another area that we might want to look at, is we do have another bill under consideration to create a non-resident spearing license for the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, and Representative Hagbart, is that the Anvil bill?
That was the junkie bill.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Dill.
I also want to make sure I understand this. Under Section 4, line 2.27, as an example, for someone aged 16 through 50, it appears to me that the lifetime sporting license would go from 613 to 985. And my concern about that is that it could price people. I mean, my 16-year-old is pretty savvy at making a buck, but seeing my buck at going from having to pay 985 instead of 613, and I'm just saying that that's an issue in that age group. And when Grandpa buys one for his 4-year-old to 15-year-old, so he can have a lifetime sporting license as a gift, Grandpa might be having trouble paying $800 on the Social Security income when the previous cost was $480. And so those are just some of my concerns on the bill. I understand what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to understand what the impacts are and illustrate some of those impacts impact this.
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, the Assistant Commissioner talked specifically about that, about having two different lifetime licenses, one that includes spearfishing and one that doesn't. Mm-hmm. And he said he would work with us on this.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Olson?
There is provisions within state law currently, because I hold a lifetime deer hunting license. It's not part of the small game license. I could certainly see where that could be segregated into a very narrow license all by itself.
Was there anyone else that had any comments regarding this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Representative McNamara. Would you like to move the bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 1143 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
To your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the audience. What you have before you today is a bill that deals with the DNR and looking at the possibility of operating in a more efficient way and to continue along the track that they've been going to contract out some of their services. Specifically, we're going to talk about two items in the DNR's budget, the growing of... Oh, you know what, Madam Chair, I should move the A09. Thank you, Representative Dale. Members and Madam Chair, if I could move the A09 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like, that would be good.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Are there any questions to the amendment?
Madam Chair, if I could just explain the amendment. The amendment narrows, the original bill was, I didn't quite get drafted the way I meant it to be. It was meant to just apply to the raising of walleye and muskie fingerlings, and the amendment clarifies that that's what it is. It doesn't deal with any of the cold water hatcheries or any of the fry production or any of that. It's just the raising of just walleye and muskie fingerling production.
Are there any questions to the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A09-0209 amendment?
Aye. Okay, good.
Everyone else? Yeah. All opposed? All right, adopted.
Thank you, ma'am. So now if I could keep going, specifically what it'll deal with is what is really unfair competition on behalf of the public sector. We have an Office of Budget Management study that you folks have in your packet that shows they analyzed a three-year study, and in the last year, the private sector was growing the walleye fingerlings for 37% cheaper than the DNR. These are family businesses. With me today, when I get done here, will be Mr. Yost, who is in the walleye fingerling business, and he can explain a little bit about his business. What's important in regards to the fisheries part, this will help with the injustice between the game and fish fund. Currently, the fish fund is taking from the game fund, and the Oversight Committee has recommended that we find ways to correct this injustice. And this potentially has the ability to correct about $700,000. Currently, the DNR is growing about $2 million worth of walleye fingerlings. And if we use the 37% that we got from the Office of Budget and Management, that would create $700,000 of, correct $700,000 of an injustice there. And then I think, Madam Chair, what I will do is maybe what we'll do is keep our discussion to the fisheries part of it now, and then I'll deal with the, I've got some testifiers, and I believe there's probably testifiers from the DNR and maybe from labor in regards to both of them, so I don't know how you want to do that. I was envisioning that we would first do the fisheries part, and then we would do the forestry part second, if that works, Madam Chair.
Well, Representative McNamara, I guess it doesn't make a great deal of difference, even though the nursery part was first. We'll, if you would like to go with the fish first, we'll do that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to committee.
My name is Rob Jost, I'm the owner of Minnesota Muskie Farm, president of the Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers Association. Me and my family live near Alexandria. I've been in the walleye and muskie fingerling business since 1990. I have degrees in natural resources and in aquaculture. If you were to look at the Minnesota DNR's own stocking records for 2008, you would find that my company alone provided 100% of all the tiger muskie fingerlings, 33% of all muskie fingerlings, and 10% of the walleye fingerlings for the DNR's statewide stocking effort. I have a long-standing and good working relationship with many DNR employees, from Dave Shad to Ron Pyre and many individuals around the state. Over the years, the DNR has been very helpful with the development of our business. Through stocking, the DNR has created the best muskie fishery in the country, and because of that, people are coming from everywhere to fish muskies in Minnesota. In my opinion, it is now time for the DNR to create the same type of walleye fishery. Every year, tens of thousands of Minnesotans are leaving the land of 10,000 lakes to go places like Canada, North Dakota, South Dakota, and even Iowa to go fishing. We should be doing everything possible to reverse this trend. The economic impact of recreational angling in Minnesota is huge. It is estimated at $2.7 billion a year and over 50,000 jobs are supported by recreational fishing activities in Minnesota. What is the foundation of this industry? It is our state fish, the walleye. The DNR walleye fingerling program during the accelerated walleye era has had huge costs to our resources. Looking at the 120,000 pounds of fingerlings the DNR should have been stocking every year for the last 9 years, it would have equaled 27,000 or 27 million fingerlings from 10 to 40 to the pound at an average of 25 fish per pound. Instead, because of their rearing methods, roughly half have been stocked into the Minnesota lakes. 13 million less walleye for angler opportunities. With that said, it is a fact that the DNR is doing a very poor and inefficient job both monetarily and operationally when it comes to rearing walleyes they are stocking. Because of the obvious important contribution we need to get the most out of our stocking. In order to accomplish this, one of two things should happen. Totally reorganize and retool the current rearing methods the DNR has been developing over the last 100 years, or transition production to the private sector, who has proven to be able to produce better fingerlings for less money than the DNR is producing. And I'd just like to close with a quote from Dave Shad, the Fish and Wildlife Chief from the DNR. This is something he said in an Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division Committee earlier this winter, this session. We agree that we don't necessarily need state employees out there raising fish if there is that capability in the private sector. We are getting a good product for a good price, and there is no reason why we shouldn't continue to kind of ratchet that up in the private sector and ratchet it down as far as something the DNR is doing directly. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Jost.
Thank you. Ms. Jost, you said in your comments that you raise a better fish. Could you tell me what that means?
The contract that we have, Madam Chair, Representative Bill, the private sector, the fish that we sell to the DNR, have certain standards they have to meet before the DNR will accept those fish. These are standards that the DNR puts upon us, of course. They can't be any larger than 10 fish per pound, which is a fish that's probably about 8 inches long to 9 inches long, and they can't be any smaller than 4 inches, and that puts them in between the 10 to 40 to the pound range. So every 100% of our fish are within that range. And over the last 3 years, we've been averaging about 45,000 pounds a year that we've been stocking in that size range. I've taken the DNR records from the last 3 years, their production records, and roughly out of the 120,000 pounds that they're stocking annually, only about 47% of those pounds are within the same standards that the DNR puts upon the private sector. So over half of the fish that the DNR is growing are are outside of those same standards they put upon the private sector.
Okay.
Representative Dill.
Okay, I think I understand that then. I took your comment that you had some, that the fish were better, meaning they were more healthier, they were more resilient, they were biologically more superior, something of that nature. But what you're really saying is the head count is different in what you what you provide and what allegedly they raise.
Madam Chair, if I could, Representative Dill. Your point, and it's the same that we heard from Director Shad, that the private sector tends to develop a much more consistent and ideal size range, and the director has testified in other committee that the quality and the background of the fish are similar, and they're happy with the fish that the private sector, and they like the idea of the consistent size is really important, and the private sector has been able to deliver that.
Madam Chair, at some point, whoever's going to testify from the department, I'd like to know. I'd like to know, and I don't know the answer to this. Why if we have a standard for the private producers, why that there's a difference between if what Mr. Yo says is true, why there's a difference between what the state is growing and what they're required to provide and they grow? And I don't know the answer, so I'd just like to know what it is.
Okay. Is there someone from the DNR Fisheries that would like to testify on this issue at this point?
Madam Chair, members, Ron Clayer, DNR Fisheries.
Welcome to the committee.
Looking for specific testimony on the bill as a whole or on Representative Dill's question particularly?
Well, I think as long as you are right there at this point, why don't you bring forward all of your remarks that you were going to make or that the DNR would like to make regarding the fisheries portion of this bill?
Madam Chair, members, I think as Director Shad mentioned, we have been ratcheting towards more privatization over the last 9 years. In the year 2000, we purchased about a little over 4,000 pounds of fingerling. Last year, it was about 46,000 pounds. So we are getting a good product. In our current contract for 2009, we're up to 50,000 pounds with potential to go to 60,000 pounds. We recognize that the fisheries production, and we all want to provide better fishing, and there's a common goal there, is going to be a combination of private public partnership, and there's three different sizes of fish we're talking about. Fry, where they come right out of the egg fry lings, which are about 1,000 to a pound, and then the fingerlings that we're talking about in this bill. We do have a walleye advisory committee that's working with our staff right now to revise the stocking guidelines. So we're looking at rate, we're looking at operational structure, and the type of questions we'll start to address some of the issues that we're talking about. One of the things in terms of the size, and Representative Bill asked that, is Pete Jacobson, a biologist, has been working on this for some time now, and the 10 to the 40 or above, 50 to the pound, provide the best return to the net, and then in theory to the angler. If you get smaller, or if you get a smaller number per pound, if you get 9 to the pound, 5 to the pound, you're putting fish in there, but it's, and they'll survive at high rates. There's just not enough numbers. The state for many years has produced fish with what we call extensive rearing. We have over 300 wetlands. We put fry in there in the spring, let those fish grow over the course of the summer to 6 or 8 inches without any aeration, without any supplemental feeding. We just go in and harvest, and it's kind of a hit and miss. What we rely on is winter kill, so at the end of each winter, we're hoping that the winter dissolved oxygen deficit has created a void so those fry survive better. The last decade has been tough to do that. We are moving towards becoming more efficient, and I think what we would look at would be the potential for the walleye stamp funding to produce that 50,000 and up to 60,000 pounds this year, and continue to take a look at where is that best balance on private-public sector. We are concerned. We have about 270 of our staff that work on walleye production. It's not individuals that's all they do year-round. There's 270 of our staff over the course of the year spend an average of 7% of their time on walleye fry-taking, stocking. And the rest of the year, they're doing other things. That other 93%, they're doing the surveys, they're doing the habitat improvement, they're doing the other things that we require to have a fisheries management program. So part of the issue, obviously, as we transition, is a cash flow issue. Every 10,000 pounds is an additional 3 full-time staff that come from various places. So we're certainly supportive of continuing that shift towards more private purchase. As Mr. Jost has said, we get a good product. Where that efficiency ends, where should the state retain some capacity? Our hatcheries also produce fry for stocking directly into lakes for provision to private industry. I think would be better served as we have the Walleye Advisory Committee and others see how this is going over the next few years. As far as poor and inefficient, and we've worked, as known Rob, for a long time, we have some inefficient operations. One of the examples, and I know Mr. Yost is looking at, is our new London hatchery facility, and we've included that in our fingerling cost, but it's been more of a research and development. We don't have many site systems where we have drainable ponds. And that facility, if you took that offline, would lower the state cost by about $2 a pound. And we use that to try to figure out frylings, fingerlings. We've had musky bass. So if we can make that shift to the private sector, we'll reduce our inefficiency. We'll get out of those ponds. We'll quit chasing those bigger fish. We'll get the fish that the private sector can provide, plus our operations will be able to provide fish in that mode. So I think the issue here is there's an end point. It shuts down our hatcheries. We sell them. It's 20% a year. I guess I don't know if we want to get to a point where it's completely privatized. We'd have to see, but we certainly think that we can move that direction more than we have at this point in time. So kind of a general summary, Madam Chair, and I'd certainly answer any questions. Roy Johannes is here, our production supervisor, and has a wealth of knowledge on some of the details of our operations.
Representative Gill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I heard the answer to my question in that testimony. So if you, without withdrawing it from that testimony, which I learned a few things on, thank you, why are your fish bigger than theirs? And why do you have less head count per pound?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, In an extensive rearing situation, if you have overwinter and fish survive, when you go in and harvest fish, you get yearlings and
so it's a winter kill, Medicare. Yeah. It's a winter kill situation, the lack of winter kill in some situations.
That's correct.
All right, thank you. I thought I heard you say that. I just want to make sure I understood it. Thank you, Medicare.
Is there any further questions? Not, are there any other people wishing to testify? Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we want to hear from the both the DNR forestry and maybe the industry testifiers in DNR forestry. I think that's going to probably be a bigger issue. And then I think, if I'm not mistaken, when we hear testimony from the labor side of it, that probably applies to both. So it might be best if we heard, I think it would be important to hear the forestry issues probably, and then, but it's up to you how you want to do it.
Right, Representative McNamara. So if there's no one else right in that wishes to testify on this issue in particular, we could move into the forestry issues. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair. Lance Neff, Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. Just a comment on the private fish hatchery section. I represent the American Fisheries Society. That would be the 270 people that the DNR mentioned. Those are the people that work in the fish hatchery. So we're just concerned that those folks are going to lose their jobs, basically, as we go down the road. And as Ron mentioned, at some point there should be an endpoint of where there's a balance between DNR responsibility and private responsibility. And that's the only part we're concerned with. So I just want to give you, be on the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neff. Are there any questions for Mr. Neff? Now, thank you for your testimony. All right, Representative McNamara.
Well, maybe, Madam Chair, if we can get one more chair, I believe there's two testifiers on behalf of the nursery, and if both Mr. Schumacher and Mr. Thayer could Sayward could come up, that'd be great. And then maybe I'll begin, Madam Chair, for you and the members to talk a little bit about the DNR nursery competes directly with the private sector in the growing of seedlings from two different nurseries, Bedora in Hubbard County and General Andrews north, if I'm not mistaken, north of Willow River. Those two nurseries currently operate somewhere in the range of 15% to 20% of capacity. Statutorily, you have some information in your packet. 8906 requires them to break even. We heard testimony in Representative Wagenius's committee that forestry acknowledges they're supposed to break even. You have their annual reports. Their 2004 report, they lost money. Their 2005 report, they lost money. Their 2006 report, they lost money. Aggregately, they add up to about $1 million of lost revenue. The 07 report I just got last week, it arrived about a year late. It does show them operating in the black. There's significant differences in the reports from 07 and the three previous years that I think it'll be important for DNR Forestry to come forward and discuss. And now I think we should hear from the industry that, folks, they directly compete with the DNR nurseries. The state of Minnesota isn't in the auto salvage business. They're not in the air freight business. They're not in the auto parts business. They're not in the hardware store business. Those happen to be three businesses that the state legislature previously operated or currently operates that sit around this table. I think these folks are real faces that compete directly, and I would tell you very, very, very unfairly. So if we could hear from both of them, I think they have short testimony, and then most importantly, it would be for DNR to come up and explain some of their operations.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. First testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Phil Sayward. My family owns and operates Itasca Greenhouse in Cohasset, Minnesota, which is in Itasca County. We purchased the business 20 years ago in 1989 and presently have 13 full-time employees, 10 part-time employees, and our payroll is just over $700,000. Our nursery grows containerized tree seedlings for conservation planning, Christmas tree liners, nursery liners, wildlife planning, shelter belts, and promotions. Our annual growing capacity is over 6 million seedlings, and last year we grew 35 species and varieties of conifers and 27 species of hardwoods. We committed our lives to growing containerized seedlings for reforestation and conservation, other conservation efforts. Among the many expenses we have incurred is capital investments in buildings and equipment, property taxes, income taxes, and interest and principal on our lines of credit and capital improvement loans, which we have to personally guarantee. The DNR Forest Nurseries have none of these costs and obligations. But they also have a statewide sales force at each DNR field office that is not paid for by the nursery. These facts create an unlevel playing field. It limits our ability to grow our business and to employ more people and, yes, pay more taxes. We're glad to have the state of Minnesota value reforestation and conservation planning. We think taxpayers in Minnesota would be better served in investing the resources that are now spent at the Bedore and General Daniels Nursery and putting them towards helping landowners purchase seedlings from private nurseries. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Hessman. Are there any questions for Mr. Sayward? If not, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Trent Schumacher, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trent Schumacher. My family owns and operates Schumacher's Nursery and Berry Farm in Heron Lake, Minnesota, in Jackson County. My father started this business in 1965, and we currently have 14 full-time employees and 15 seasonal employees. Our nursery produces over 3 million conservation-grade trees and shrubs annually. Our customers include soil and water conservation districts, private landowners, municipalities, and retail nurseries. We have committed our livelihood to providing plants for conservation to prevent erosion and provide wildlife habitat. Every day we pay taxes of one sort or another. Some of these taxes are used to build roads, for instance, and we think this is a good use of our tax dollars. However, I think it's important to point out that the asphalt that is used in those roads is not produced by a state-owned operation. Citizens value those roads, and I believe that the citizens of Minnesota value environmental improvement through reforestation and conservation plannings as well. But just like the citizens wouldn't expect the state to own an asphalt plant, I don't think they're expecting the state to operate a nursery, producing trees that the private sector can do just as well. Our company and our industry welcome the chance to work with the DNR to help achieve environmental improvement, but it's tough to do that and compete with them at the same time. In these economic times that are tough for all of us, give us a chance to grow our business, and please help pass House File 1143. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Schumacher? Representative Dill.
Madam Chair, this would be for either of the testifiers. Are there trees, containerized trees, being imported into Minnesota now?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Dill. Yes, there's a lot of containerized tree seedlings coming in from Canada, from PRT, which is a large, formerly government-sponsored, of an old nursery that now has been privatized and still supported by the Canadian government, and also other nurseries in Canada, which include the Manitoba Provincial Nursery. In the United States, there's a lot of containerized seedling nurseries in the North Pacific Northwest and the Rocky Mountain area, which supply their regions. They do not import into this region. And in the northeastern Canada, there's a lot of containerized nurseries that supply seedlings for reforestation in Quebec, New Brunswick, PEI, and Newfoundland.
Follow up to that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what you're saying is the same argument about the state being in the business. You can't compete with the Manitoba trees because the Canadian government is still in the business and subsidizing them. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Sayward.
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, that's correct. Though recently things are starting to tilt in our favor. As you're probably well aware, the building industry in the United States has gone into the can. And because of that, Canadian forestry, which is harvests a lot of crown land, which is required to be forest, is not being cut as much. The nurseries in Canada are hurting in terms of being able to supply the number of seedlings. PRT alone has closed two nurseries that I know of, possibly three nurseries, and just because there's no need for the volume up there. And the other thing that's helped us
is back when we first had the big competition on the Canadian dollar, it was 63 cents. Now the Canadian dollar is more on par, and we can compete better.
Representative Bill.
Well, the Canadian dollar this morning was at 21 cents American. So, I mean, it's 21 cents less, and it's not par anymore. It was actually worth more. I happen to live on the Canadian border. I know a little something about that. So as that starts to dry up, that those imports are, is your industry going to be, are your nurseries going to be able to pick up the slack for the demand? Or will that slack be picked up by the excess of trees that the DNR has?
Mr. Sayward.
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, we're willing to expand and have expanded. I just added a 2 million tree expansion to our greenhouse 2 years ago. We'll still be paying for that for the next 10 to 15 years. My banker will help me expand, provided I have firm commitments and financing to be able to get the financing. I can't expand beyond what I can estimate selling. So a lot of it depends on commitment of the DNR and other customers that we have to be able to increase their sales and our production capacity.
One last question.
Representative Bill.
Thank you again. Give me an idea of the scale of a 2 million tree expansion. Is that 100 acres, 100 feet, a square mile? What does that mean to us?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sayward.
Representative Bill. My addition is roughly a half an acre more of production, a little bit less than a half an acre that is producing. I used to produce 2 million in my old group now, and now I can add that by 60 to 70% depending on the container size that we're growing in. Yeah, these are grown in a greenhouse, not in the field.
Thank you.
Are there any additional questions? Were there other testifiers, I think, to the bill?
Madam Chair, I believe the DNR probably would like to testify.
Thought they might.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Olin Phillips. I'm the Forest Management Protection Section Manager for the Department of Natural Resources, and under that, my responsibilities include providing oversight to our State Forest Nursery Program that's addressed in this bill. As indicated in the bill before you, and also in the testimony that you've heard so far, the Department currently operates two State Forest Nurseries, one near Willow River and the other near Akeley, Minnesota. These two nurseries are self-supporting facilities, as was directed under Minnesota statutes change and implemented in 1984, and have continued to be self-supporting and run in the black since that date. Overall, on the bill, on an annual basis, there have been fluctuations, as that is, as Representative McNamara has mentioned. The purpose that the DNR has in running these two nurseries has always been, for the last 80 years in which we've had a state forest nursery in the state, has been to provide high-quality, native, bare-root seedlings from known seed sources to support our conservation initiative programs within the state and reforestation and restoration of our forests. The DNR has produced seedlings, like I said, for 80 years during this time. During this time, the statutes that have governed the operations of the state forest nurseries that are included in Minnesota Statutes 89 have been structured and modified to restrict seedling use to rural reforestation and afforestation efforts, and also to prevent their use for ornamental plantings of any type, and to make sure that they are rural reforestation efforts. In part, this has been done to prevent competition with our private nurseries, and it was undertaken for that purpose. In 1997, the Minnesota Statutes 89 were modified to place a 10 million seedling cap, production cap, on seedlings produced and sold from our state forest nurseries. The purpose of this production cap was to provide an expanded opportunity for our private sector nursery partners to expand their operations to take up more of the market share that was out there at that time. The DNR supported that change in the legislation after convening a roundtable group that included many of the broad stakeholders that are involved and impacted by the decision whether the state has a nursery or not, and the need for these materials. Again, you know, we're driven by the goal at our state forest nursery system to come in with its native, known seed source, conservation regeneration materials that maintain the genetic diversity and support the initiatives that we see within the state. And it's in this continued interest in trying to work with the private sector to partner as we went forth after 1997 legislation was adopted, that the division and department has worked with the governor's office to bring before you the forest productivity for the future budget initiative that you have that talks about building a stronger public and private partnership and how we meet the conservation regeneration needs into the future. We feel that that has been discussed with you in our budget overview probably, and you may remember that. And the purpose of this really is to talk about how we should go forward in a public and private sector involvement in the nursery system. And we feel in the department it isn't appropriate to re-examine how the public-private nursery structure exists within the state of Minnesota. I think that's been done continually over the life of our nursery, and we shouldn't be free of that now. But the position of the DNR is that this activity should include that full, broad stakeholder group, and that's what we would prefer to see. We think that the Forest for the Future initiative, Forest Productivity for the Future initiative, allows us to do that. And so, before undertaking an action as recommended in House File 1143, we would like to pursue that action first.
Are there questions?
One.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Phillips, how many people are employed by the nurseries that the DNR operates?
We employ approximately 200 total seasonal and permanent full-time positions, about 35 permanent staff, and the remainder would be seasonal positions.
Thank you. Representative
Bill. Are any of these people employed, students and like that, or are they, what kind of people do the temporary, the seasonal employees?
Chairman, Representative Purcell, most of these are actually local citizens in the area that want on. Actually, the age structure of that is, I mean, very heavy towards our senior citizen complement. I'm not sure they'd all qualify for a free license under the previous bill discussed, but we do employ them from the local community surrounding the nurseries, and there are very few students involved in that.
Representative Neal.
Okay, so now I want to make absolutely sure I got it right. The 35 you talk about thereabouts, those are permanent state employees.
Permanent full-time, Madam Chairman, Representative Bill, permanent full-time position.
Thank you.
So I just had a question, if you could tell me a little bit about, I noticed that Soil and Water Conservation District purchased seedlings from State Forest and Nurseries for resale for conservation purposes. Could you tell me a little bit about, you know, how this change might affect them, if indeed you know, since you're not actually the Soil and Water District?
Madam Chairman, the Minnesota Statute 89 provides the provision that Soil and Water Conservation Districts are allowed to purchase seedlings from us for resale. They're the only entity that is allowed to do that. Right now, the predominance of seedlings made available through the Soil and Water Conservation Districts are made available by private nurseries. We still provide a small segment of that seedling production, but it's not nearly as significant as it used to be in previous years.
Representative Gill.
Knowing absolutely nothing about trees except to just grow for the sake of growing, how many trees would you say that you don't end up using that you grow in the course of a year? You said you had a cap of 10 million, and I remember that was changed back in the 90s sometime.
Right.
Are all of those, is the demand you can use all of those, you sell all of those, how are those disposed of, and how many of them are disposed of? And I don't mean that thrown away, I mean used.
I'm Chairman, Representative Bill, in some situations we are forced to essentially plow them under so they can regenerate the next crop. In 2008, our production was and sales were about 8.4 million seedlings of the 10 million cap that we had available to produce to. Out of that, we probably produced an additional 2 million seedlings on top of that. What we attempt to do is whatever seedlings that we can hold and offer a bigger product the next year, we will hold over, or else we'll make in a transplant that are used in some reforestation efforts, particularly in windbreaks. They're more open to the use of transplants because they like the bigger stock. And so we try to maintain as much as possible without losing that investment, of course, because it's a financial impact to the nursery itself. This year
when you say seedling, Representative McNamara gives each of us a small tree this tall on Arbor Day as a gift. And is that what you're talking about? Is that what you're selling for reforestation, those same type of trees, seedlings that Representative McNamara gives us as a gift? Are you familiar with that person? Is that is that what we're talking about?
Madam Chairman, Representative Bill, we produce bare root seedlings of the type you are. That's a fairly large seedling for the rural reforestation efforts that we produce. Generally, our seedlings run for a Norway pine or somewhere in the 6 to 9 inch tall range above the root system, and those are the general size that are best available for rural replanting efforts.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Just to answer Representative Gill, the Barrett seedlings that we've bought historically have come from Mr. Sayward's nursery in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. It just so happens I haven't. Representative Hansen, Representative Osmond, Representative Solberg had historically done that. This coming year, the Barrett Burr Oak are actually coming from the Schumacher Nursery down in Heron Lake. I thought it would be good to geographically balance. And we purchased those. Representative Hansen, myself, Representative Osmond, Representative Solberg have shared in that cost, and we buy them from our private sector. If I could, Madam Chair, I think it's important. I was very surprised to hear Mr. Phillips. I think you should know that the Schumacher's operation has 14 full-time employees and 14 seasonal, substantially smaller number of employees. I think I'm very surprised. This is a $2 million operation. This DNR nursery, it has 35 permanent full-time employees, and I'm assuming Mr. Phillips is counting everybody that drew a paycheck, but 160 additional temporary employees or seasonal employees is an astronomical amount of employees in the operation. I think it's important that folks realize this. We are talking about an industry that is much better suited to be a family-run operation where they can gain efficiencies in highly seasonal, extremely short amount of time done. It was begun in the Depression when we had 25% unemployment. We are basically operating these nurseries today under that model still today. They're operating at somewhere around 15 to 20%. Why they operate two of them is beyond me. Why would they wouldn't bring them into one and operate them at one and at least get to a 30-40% capacity efficiency is beyond comprehension. And I guess, Madam Chair, at some point I would like to ask Mr. Phillips a couple of questions about some substantial difference between the 02 to 06 report and the 07 report. But I want to respect your time.
One more question. Representative Hill.
Thank you. And Mr. Phil, is there any genetic reasons why we'd want to stay with the way we do it now? Those folks and you folks. And is there any reason genetically, and is that the right word, the genetics of the tree, or you know what I'm trying to get at, native qualities of the tree? Is that an issue between the private and the state?
Mr. Phillips.
Chairman. Representative Bill, this is one of our continuing concerns of why, when in 1996 we conducted a major roundtable process to bring all our stakeholders in that were involved in the private landowners' representation. Many of the environmental groups came and participated, and the concern was that the state move forward and ensure that we have native, diverse genetics in this tree species that we're using for reforestation. Their concern was that they, at that point in time, is that commitment was not yet structured in the private industry. Not that it can't be structured in the private industry. And I want to make that true. They have the ability to do that. At current, we haven't, they did not see that confirmation and long-term commitment there. So when we talk about growing oak, and let me use a partner that's not represented here in the room, because and they're very well known, and Bachman produces, or Bailey's will produce nursery maple seeds, sugar maple seeds that are flaming red, and they've got varieties out there. And this is why we've always stayed away from ornamentals. But as you neck down your genetics towards something that has a specific display, then you limit the genetic diversity that we feel is necessary to put back into our forest to maintain that viability against all the different stresses that we have. And I'll stop there for some of your questions.
One last question.
Representative Deal.
How does that, Ms. Phillips and Madam Chair, how does that stack up then when the Manitoba trees come in? Do we have any logs that import? I mean, you know, all we do around here now is talk about VHS and exotic species and every other imaginable thing, and rightfully so. So now are we emerald ash borer, as an example? What assurances do we have that they aren't sending down trees, although they look nice and pretty? Across the other side of my lake, they look real good. But, you know, what assurances do we have that they are not changing our genetic structure?
Madam Chairman, Representative Bill, one of the significant things that occurs in our nurseries that doesn't always rise to the top when you talk about seedling production is we also have a major seed collection effort that collects and documents seed sourced across the state. The seedlings that we receive from our container production and those not only from our Canadian counterparts but also from Mr. Sayward's facility, we provide the seed for those plantings. They grow Minnesota seed that we provided from our known sources to maintain that genetic confidence that we have there.
And so, Madam Chair, sorry to keep going, but so you're 35, Mr. Phillips, Madam Chair, you're 35 full-time people. Are they involved in that aspect of this as well?
Mr. Phillips.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, yes, seed collection and the sorting and the and processing of seed is also a function that we do in the kind of all seasonal months of the nursery.
And so, Madam Chair,
Representative Dill,
what kind of a percentage? I'm thinking back to Representative McNamara's question when he compared the department against the private industry and the number of people versus the number of people. What percentage of time are you collecting seeds so that you can provide them to the private industry of those 35 people?
Mr. Phillips.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dill, I'd say you're talking about probably about 20% of our permanent complement that you see represented in the numbers I mentioned.
So, Madam Chair, that would narrow that gap to some degree there.
Just so I can, and those are great questions, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Deal, because seed source is something that not only the public sector and the private sector, I think Mr. Phillips would agree, the private sector realizes the importance of local ecotypes and the very, very importance of where the seeds came from. And that's another reason to move to the private sector. The private sector nurseries are located throughout the state. Just the two we have, one is from Grand Rapids, one is from Heron Lake. The two DNR nurseries are geographically in the same zone number. They don't have the diversity that we have, whether it's Gary Lee's nursery in Fertile, Minnesota, or Bailey's in Newport, or Bachman's in Lakeville, or Schumacher's in Heron Lake, Mr. Sayward in Grand Rapids. We have nurseries all spread throughout Minnesota that add to that diversity, and I think that's really adds to the importance. As far as the seed collection, I am sure that both Mr. Sayward and the Schumachers collect seed, but if they don't collect it, they pay for it. So they are either, in some cases, I would imagine, they are important. This goes similar to the fish issue about the fry. Our industry, both in the fish and in the tree seedlings, need to be concerned about good source seed source, I'll call it, or egg source in both, because if we got either bad seed source or bad walleye eggs,
potentially maybe they couldn't live in that warm water of Crane Lake as opposed to Heron Lake. You know, Madam Chair, rather than me asking a lot of questions of the DNR forestry, which I had planned on, I want to respect the committee's time, and I know there's other people who want to testify on the other side of the bill, and I want to respect their option. I do not want to cut them off. They have an important message to deliver, and I think we should allow the Ask Me folks rather than me take up the time in my questions.
Thank you, Representative McNair. Would the other testifiers from Earville Arola? Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, and members of the House Game and Fish Committee and Forestry Division, my name is Daryl Arola, and the also the Vice President and Chief Steward of AFME Local 718, which represents DNR employees in Northeast Minnesota region. Also, I've worked as a fisheries technician in Grand Rapids, and I've also worked for about 22 years. I've been worked in fisheries most of my career for about 32 years. I know this business because I've been working here stocking and working in the production of walleyes for fingerlings for almost 30 years. This bill raised some concerns about my job, and I'm concerned about that. And I wanted to comment that the DNR employees, there's a very professional staff that raise these fish. And we use the best scientific practices and knowledge is available to produce a wildly genetic diverse fish that can survive and grow in a natural aquatic environment of our lakes and streams. The state raised fish are disease free, so the best that we can do is create them prevent diseases in our fish when stocked in our lakes and streams. And the goal is to protect our public waters, and public employees are best equipped to do that. And to protect our natural resources and fishing tourism, Minnesota must maintain a high quality of fish that we raise in stock. And when you compare costs, compare the quality also, and ask yourself, are we going to be accountable? Who is going to be accountable to the public if our fish die or if the lakes become populated with diseased fish? Yeah, today, the state does purchase some of our fish from the private vendors. And I've been directly involved with helping them show them where the lakes are, because a lot of vendors don't even know where the public accesses are. So we go there, and we also make sure that those fish are stress-free. The stress-free, they swim away, and we're also making sure that there's no exotics mixed in, whether it's such as carp or bullheads. I'm up in the Grand Rapids area, and the last thing I want to do is have a carp come up there, because we've been spending many years keeping carp out of Northeast Minnesota. So I take a lot of pride in my work, and I feel a lot of responsibility in my work too, and so do my coworkers. And we create quality fishing experiences for almost 2.1 million anglers in this state. This is not a time to cut our jobs and sacrifice our experience. I have also want to comment that we do have a strong union in our state, AFME, and because of that, we do have decent paying jobs. And we're proud of it. We get health insurance benefits. I believe a lot of these jobs in the private industry do not provide all the same level of benefits that are produced by the jobs that we in the state as a state employee and public employee. So with that, our jobs, I've been able to raise a family, purchase a house, send kids to college, do all the right things that is the American dream, and just because of our benefits and our wage package. I make no apologies for that. I've been very proud to be a state employee and a public employee. Therefore, I urge you to oppose this House File 1143, because it makes no sense to close and privatize DNR fish hatcheries and tree nurseries. Also, I wanted to comment that I do too pay taxes of all types every day from the wages I earn as a public employee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Arola. Are there any questions for the testifiers? If not, please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Dennis Blumke, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've worked at the DNR Fisheries and as a technician in the New London Fish Hatchery. I've worked for the DNR for 32 years, 4 years with forestry and 28 with fisheries. I'm also an AFME local 694 president, which does represent all the fishery personnel worked in the hatchery. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 1143, which will close the private state fish hatcheries and tree nurseries over the next 5 years. Maintaining healthy lakes and forests is a government responsibility. That's why protection of our natural resources should remain with the state. I want to caution you about closing the fish hatcheries. If the state sells off its assets and lays off its workers, and the private aren't able to provide what's wanted, what's needed, then it'll be a very costly operation to reopen the state hatcheries and buy a new one. Take that into account. State hatcheries do more than just raise fish. We stock fish, we protect water quality, we monitor water quality, and we do public relations and education programs that boost tourism within our community. If anybody has been to the fish hatcheries, we have tours every Friday. And we have tours for sportsmen's groups late at night, on weekends, as whenever they call and need it. So our properties are open, and we do provide public education as part of our normal workload. We also do responsibilities with research projects and stream investigational work, which helps monitor a healthy environment for the fish that we're stocking. I'm not sure that you're going to get that with the private industry. Their primary motive is profit. Do you really want to give up these services just to cut costs? I'm asking you to take a second look at that. You can entrust the DNR workers to improve and protect the habitat of fish that we've got. Asking you to make government more efficient during this budget crisis by cutting corners on disease prevention, health, and healthy lakes is a risky business. Fishing is a major industry in Minnesota with about 44,000 fishing-related jobs and $340 million in fishing-related revenue. Don't put that all at risk by trusting private vendors to get the job done right. The DNR operates a number of fish hatcheries located around the state. And in towns that lose a fishery employee, each town will lose customers with their DNR layoff, which is no path to economic recovery. Layoffs don't help anybody. Private vendors are in the business of making a profit. DNR employees are in the focus of quality, protection of the natural resources, and accountability to the public. Fish hatcheries and trees should remain the state and not be privatized. One other point I wanted to make, which I haven't heard mentioned earlier in other testimonies, is there appears to be a very uneven balance of cost. I mean, the state, when we estimate our cost, every mile on every vehicle is all documented, every man hour is accounted for, every outboard, a motor we use, the hours are used, the trailers used, each hour is accounted for. I don't know that that's the case with when private do their accountability. I haven't seen it, so that may be the case. But I'm guessing that there's some difference. If you're going to compare the lowest bid against production costs at the hatcheries, it appears to me to be an unfair disadvantage. I want you to take that into accountability. The other thing that the DNR is less likely to mention is that we have a lot of overhead that goes into our accounting of our hatchery cost of our fingerlings, and that's justifiable because every time they speak with a group in relation to that, their time gets counted towards that, and it's documented. And we do that mainly because a lot of that funding is reimbursed by the federal government, all of our costs. So if you took out some of those reimbursable costs, the comparison in cost is much more in balance with the actual cost. So I thank you for your time.
Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative McNair.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify a couple of things. The bill as amended in the 09 amendment does not close hatcheries. This is a bill about fingerling production. You have a study from the Office of Management and Budget that it's 37% cheaper to do it in the private sector. The private sector does a better job, creates a more consistent product, and does it through efficient operations. They do it in a drastically smaller number of wetlands throughout the state of Minnesota. They're working in smaller number of waters in a more efficient way, creating a more consistent product. These private sector businesses pay taxes on where their facilities are located, unlike the DNR. I'm sorry, but the Schumachers and the Itasca Greenhouse and the fisheries people can't hide the cost of an outboard motor. They have to put it all against their own business. It's their only business. It's what they do. They have to make money at it. And when they make money, they pay taxes. And in regards to pension plans, you can rest assured that before all of us at this table leave the legislature in our lifetime, we will again put money in to save public employees' pensions. We will not be saving the pensions of the private companies. They do that on their own. It's their own money. And they make a living at doing that in an efficient way. AFSCME themselves just said they want to operate more efficiently. If we can't look at these two businesses, when it's documented in black and white that they're costing the state a large amount of money, 37%, if we cut it in half, we've just settled the budget deficit with a huge surplus. I think it's important, folks, that we realize there's some things that we used to do in state government that we should consider not doing anymore. Folks, I came from a family whose father worked for the state of Minnesota for 36 years. I am not out to trash public employees. This is a 5-year transition to allow them to change. Fisheries have acknowledged private sector can do it better. Unfortunately, forestry hasn't gotten there yet, but I believe they will. They realize the private sector can do it better, and they will move on. And this bill is just to encourage that. Thank you.
Representative Dill.
I actually have a question for Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, members, Ron Pryor, DNR Fisheries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Pryor, Representative McNamara just referenced, actually I was thinking, not ahead of him, that never happens, but I was thinking on the same line he was thinking. Could you tell me about the amount of wetland that is impacted to grow the DNR's fish versus the private industry fish? Representative McNamara stated that the private industry fish are grown in a lot less wetlands. And I'm trying to get that, if you're doing 40,000 and you're raising 160, or we've got 160 that we need, is that just less meaning because they're less fish, or how do we get that scale? How do we understand that as a committee? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I do. I think the state uses about 25,000 acres.
for rearing purposes, and the private sector licenses quite a number. I don't know if Mr. Johannes could give you that number. The state has used what we call extensive rearing. We don't fertilize, we don't actively manage those wetlands, and for many years that was a pretty successful theory when we had winter kill every year. And so one of the advantages of shifting some of the production over to the private sector is we're not into some of those less productive ponds, but that's one of the reasons that the private sector more intensively manages, and we could certainly do that as well from a state perspective. Did you want, Madam Chair, Representative Dill, did you want those numbers on the private sector? Mr. Johannes could give you the acres that they use.
Well, I guess I'd like to refine my question. I guess if you could just tell me, is it less intrusive or more intrusive what the DNR is doing or what the private sector is doing? And I'll tell you why. One of the questions has been asked in the Finance Committee, as you're aware, are the remediation costs included in the numbers that we're looking at from the department as well as the private sector? And I'm just kind of pouring around in the wetland, so to speak, trying to get some information that might be useful.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, the remediation costs are not included in either. As you probably recall, the state is working to develop best management practices for wetlands. There's been a report there. It's a fairly complex issue to try to develop those, and we're in the process. We've had a group. We've contracted the University of Minnesota and St. Thomas to help us develop those best management practices, and when we get to that point, that will help guide answering some of those questions. But at this point in time, we're really not able to put a quantitative amount on that. And Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I would say on average, the state on average is less intrusive. We don't do active management. In some cases, the private sector does. They'll aerate, feed, supplemental feed, and in some cases, that may be appropriate.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, what's the You say we're starting, or somebody at the university is starting to measure potential impacts, ecological impacts. Is that, I mean, can you, you know, you increase the nutrients in the sediment in that pond by 20% over so many years? I mean, is there anything that you know about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, what the university, the two universities are doing is try to develop a process to look at best management practices, and nutrient loading would certainly be one. There's been a fair amount of work that would demonstrate the status of a turbid pond versus a clearwater pond, and in some cases fish species can add to that turbidity, which impacts waterfall, and that's part of the genesis of this issue. So there's a fair amount that's known developing that practice, and then one of the challenges will be how do you allocate accountability for any changes in that wetland, because it's also reflected on what's going on in that watershed in addition to any fish introduction. So it'll be an involved process, and we'll try to get to those answers through that process the best we can.
Representative Purcell.
Can you just say a little bit about what feed, if any, is being used in ponds? You said the DNR doesn't put feed in, and you're using ponds that have bad edge in them or something, and what's the comparison there? Can you just give me an idea on that, of what feed's being used in other ponds, if and when it's being used?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Roy Johannes. I'm with the Fish and Wildlife Division.
Mr. Johannes.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, what we're looking at is different practices and techniques that are used for rearing fish. And as Ron Pyre mentioned, that our typical methods are probably just minimizing our footprint on wetlands around the state by just stocking fry and harvesting fingerlings in the fall. There's other intensive practices that may be used by the private sector during the year. They may be intensively removing fish year-round. they may be adding nutrients to help them get fry going in the springtime by upping plankton. They may be adding minnows in the fall to feed their fish to get them up to size in a quick scenario. I know that a lot of times fathead minnows is one that's used for that. So there are some repercussions for introducing fathead minnows in wetlands at times. And they, as Ron mentioned, they can change the water quality from a clear water pond to a turbid pond. In a time frame, they can shift back and forth. But those are the types of activities that may occur.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify. Director Pryor mentioned about the fertilization, and I wanted to get it on the record that the fertilization takes place in man-made ponds. The industry does not fertilize, put nutrients like that in the public waters where they're raising walleye fingerlings. The difference is the industry is working with the DNR, and I think they're on the same page of adopting the best management practices. The industry uses less number of wetlands. They already got fatheads in them when they introduce the walleye fry. They will introduce additional fatheads on an as-needed basis, and that develops a more consistent walleye fingerling. At the end of the year, there are less fathead minnows in the pond than there was at the beginning of the year. So they've cleared up the water. The other difference I meant to mention before was one of the AFSCME employees mentioned about cleaning out carp and bullheads. Standard practice in the private sector is to remove the rough fish, not carp, but because they wouldn't go in waters where there's carp, but they go in waters where there's bullheads or white suckers. The private sector does remove those rough fish because they compete with the walleye. The DNR's practice is to leave those fish alone and not touch the removal of them. So in best management practices, which are being developed by the colleges, I think we may see that suggestion to take what the private sector is already doing in a proactive way and suggest to our DNR employees that they do that. The bigger discussion would be, should we use the wider, be in more wetlands? Are we potentially degrading more wetlands that way? Or should we more intensely be in smaller wetlands? Or should we go to the Wisconsin method, forget fingerlings, go to all frylings and grow them in man-made ponds? In Wisconsin, they don't allow. This is getting us to the Representative Scalzi, Representative Wagenius issue, Madam Chair, that we will be here till Representative Murphy's committee's timeline.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara. Are there any further questions for these two testifiers? There's one more testifier, I believe. McDonald's.
Madam, members of the House, I'm Jeff McDonald. I'm a member of AFSCME Local 1623. I live in Park Rapids and I work up with the ownership in Akeley. I'm here to speak in opposition of House File 1143, which would eliminate the state tree nursery. The bill calls for DNR to close one tree nursery within 2 years and close the second in 2013. Our state nursery program wasn't designed to compete with private nurseries. We do what private vendors don't do in order to meet the state conservation goals. We wear seedlings that are native, and we sell them at a reasonable cost to allow us to recover production and infrastructure costs. We are not in the business to turn a profit. We also help create healthy forest ecosystems. We do that by maintaining genetic diversity of tree species needed to regenerate and restore Minnesota forests. I take pride in my work, and I do so, and so do my co-workers. This is not the time to cut our jobs and sacrifice our experiences. I urge you to oppose the bill, file 1143. It makes no sense to close and privatize the DNR
tree nursery. Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony. actually Representative McNamara. I just had a couple of quick questions on whether they are for you or for some of your testifiers or others. One was on the fisheries, and I'm just wondering, kind of going back to some earlier testimony discussing, long-term ramifications, I'm just wondering if the private fisheries and nurseries, if they provide health benefits, and, you know, if they do, are they commensurate with the ones that the state do, or are their employees, similar to some other businesses we've heard of in the past, then asking their employees to sign up for Minnesota Care or something so that there is additional state skin in the game regard on that?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to, I had the discussion with actually all of them, and they acknowledged to me that they do have health insurance and pensions. And I'm going to talk a little bit to answer that. I was in the green industry for 30 years. I still am looking for someone's pension plan to offer the one that my business partner Hoff and I had for 26 years while we owned the company. It continues to have what I believe is a second to none pension plan anywhere. And I'll again reiterate, there is no obligation for the state to pick up the hidden our fund took in the last year and a half because of the stock market plunge. What I will say, and I guess I will ask the DNR, we did provide health insurance for our seasonal employees and picked up 100% of the cost when those seasonal employees were out of work. I guess I would like to ask the DNR if the 200 seasonal employees are eligible for insurance at those nurseries, or if insurance is only for the full-time year-round employees. And actually, Madam Chair, I'll defer to you whether they really have to answer that. My point is, don't make the assumption that the public sector has a better pension and health insurance, folks, because you better come to my office and visit me, because you can, and Representative Dill and other ones at the table, we got to be real careful if you're going to go down that road, because there's examples, folks. When you put profit motivation behind people, don't make the assumption it's going to cost more, folks. You could ask the Schumachers, were they down there Saturday or Sunday checking on the cooler or wondering what the temperature was to make sure the bare root stuff didn't freeze? Probably so. Either them, their mom Judy, or their dad Dean. And folks, I don't know if anybody was at Bedora over the weekend. Maybe they were. I hope they were, but I don't know. There's economies here, folks, that there's things the government should do, and there's things the government should think about getting out of.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. I just have a question directed at the entire industry, not just your particular business in the past. And then I just had one other follow-up, and I'm just wondering, you know, forestry is such an important piece of our state economy, and I was just wondering if there are, you know, guarantees if the state wasn't doing any seedlings, that this, what would be the impact of, you know, or would the cost to the timber industry then escalate? Is there anyone that could speak to that, or is that just sort of an ambiguous question?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, that your point, we want to make sure that there's not a void. Because if there's a void in 2 or 3 years, I know who's going to be getting looked at, and I don't want that on my shoulders. We have to make sure, Representative Dill asked some of those questions, we have to be sure that the private industry is going to step up and fill the void. And if they're not going to step up and fill the void, we can't be closing down either the walleye fingerling production or the tree nurseries. With the Lessard Council funding that's in place and the whole dedicated money potential, we have to be sure that the industry is there to meet the needs of the future. That's more important than anything this bill does, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, Representative McNamara, I'm not speaking against your bills, and it's fine if you want to talk about any efficiencies and things, but just in regard to the state employee, I was a state employee for 20-some years, and I have a very healthy pension because of it, and I thank all you taxpayers that donated to that. And I'm still collecting, hopefully, until I die, and I'm not ashamed of it. The other thing is, the state employees are a wonderful lot. We throw this term around, state employees, public employees, in a kind of a derogatory manner sometimes. I work with a lot of them in fisheries and nurseries, and the fisheries people actually had a heart, and they liked to they brought the fish out to help them stock, to help them net, to help them net rough fish and fries and fingerling and and or with them when they came off the clock. So efficiency is good and everything. I just want to make sure we're not knocking state employees because they're the person next door. They're the person who's also babysitting for you. They're from our community. They're not imported from Canada, and they're real people. So not, like I said, I'm not speaking against the bill. And efficiency is fine and all this. But I just want to make sure in the end game that we come up, we're not knocking the state employees and that we've taken care of them to put up with whatever we do in a sensible manner. So.
Anyone else? Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to lay House File 1143 over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Representative McNamara lays House File 1143 as amended will be laid over for further consideration.
Okay, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move
on.
I'll do it right here. House File 1132 to be recommended to pass and sent to the Environment Policy Committee chaired by Representative Eakin.
Okay, Representative Hill moves House File 1132 be recommended pass and you refer to the Committee on Environment Policy and Oversight. And I believe there's a DE1 to get in the shape that the author wants.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, there is a DE1, and then I have a variety of a series of oral amendments to the DE1, and I will read them off.
Well, yeah, why don't we go with the oral amendments first now? All
right. If the members could pull out the DE1 amendment. And the first amendment is on line 1.1. Change the word stumpage to timber.
1.10, right?
Right. The word stumpage to timber. Line 1.13, change the date to January 15th rather than July 15th. On line 1.18, remove the words up to 40,000 acres of. That would be up to 40,000 acres of. On line 1.19, put a period after the word purposes and then delete for a term not to exceed 21 years in the period. And then on line 1.23, after the word public access, insert for hunting, fishing, motorized, and non-motorized recreation. So it would then read, for public access, for hunting, fishing, motorized, and non-motorized recreation to the leased land. That is the same as would be available under state management. So since that's kind of a long one, I'll just repeat the inserted words one more time. The inserted words on line 1.23 after the word access would be for hunting, fishing, and motorized and non-motorized recreation. And that is the amendment to the DE1.
Incorporate that.
I'd like to incorporate that into the DE1, and then I'll stand for questions on the DE1, Mr. Chair, as amended.
Does anyone else have questions on that? Do we need to repeat that? Anyone got it? Okay, seems like anyone else has it. Representative Dill incorporates the oral amendment to the DE1. Why don't we vote on the DE1, and then he'll explain the bill as amended. All those in favor of the DE1 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. Representative Dill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for your generosity and understanding the amendments that we made to this. The bill does two things. It increases the amount of timber that will be sold on an appraiser's estimate. And one of the things we want to accomplish in this is that we sell the entire tree based on an estimate rather than the actual
when the logger cuts the trees, has the tree scaled, and then has to put tickets in the box, and quite a process. Now the forestry goes out and they scale the wood, and if the forestry underjudges the amount of wood there, the logger would come out better. And if the forestry underjudges the amount of wood there, the logger wouldn't come out as well. But nonetheless, the whole thing revolves around the fact that he buys it as is, kind of like a used car, so to speak. And that is basically, it also requires a report to the House and the Senate on the findings of the evaluation of that process. And, you know, the bill doesn't have us jumping into changing the whole system. It has us working into it and evaluating it as we go. And the DNR can come up and speak to the bill as well. And I'm going to go ahead and explain the second part as well. The second part, Section 2, beginning on line 1.16, is regarding lease pilot project. This language would allow for the commissioner to lease state-owned forest lands for forest management purposes to, let's say, large landowners, like I'm going to use some examples, Forest Capital Partners, Blandon, and others, that land that might be more advantageous for the private sector to manage because of its location, because, you know, we have quite a checkerboard of ownership up there, in an instance where it would make more sense to have someone else manage it rather than us sending our resources out there to manage it, and allows us then to manage the resources that we should be managing better. And that's the purpose of this. And also, as you can see in section in item 2 on line 1.1, on line 1.23, if we lease that land, much like conservation easements in the sense of access, we want to make sure that because it is public land, that we maintain, even though it may be leased for forest management purposes, the right for the public, the actual owner of the land, to use it for hunting, fishing, motorized, and non-motorized recreation. As well, this also requires a report by the commissioner to the respective House committees on the pilot project and the details of the plan and implementation of the project starting no later than July 1, 2010. So that's just a rough description of the bill, and maybe Mr. Tomlinson would like to come up and comment on both sections, since one is regarding the selling of timber, the process of selling timber, and the second part is the part about managing it and manage it more efficiently. So, Mr. Tomlinson, could you come up and answer any questions on how the... And I think the department supports the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Tomlinson, state your name for the record.
Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, yes, we've been working with the author over on the Senate side, now with Representative Dill on this side.
So I'm sure let's vote to try
to have the bill, you know, together. We think they're both good measures. They're both more or less going to help us, hopefully in the future, sometime in the future, reduce costs and be more efficient in the way we're operating in the department. We've got a very significant workload, and this will help us address a couple of things that are really important to us in the future. Both of them are pilots, is, you know, studies more or less, evaluating. We want to carefully move in this direction and do it cautiously and carefully, and one that makes sense not only for us in the department, but also for the taxpayers and the forest products industries and others as well. So we're anxious to kind of work forward with this. And rather than taking along any time reiterating much of what Representative Dill already suggested, he kind of explained the nuances of what we're attempting to do here, I thought, rather well. I just stand for any questions given the late time of the day here and stuff. So
questions from the members? Doesn't seem like it. Are they any?
Just curious how we, the people, the taxpayers, get our money back out if the appraiser underestimates, and where's the payback on that for the taxpayer?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I think the payback would be that there's less time that we spend on that activity with the consumer scale business end of the work. That's kind of where we're spending a fair amount of time right now. One could suggest that when whether we may be underappraised, we might overappraise as well. We have guidelines that we're looking for to be met when we're going out and doing this appraisal work, and we expect all of our appraisers to come in within those. What we'll, with this bill, with, at least with this pilot effort, we're going to have to just make sure that we're doing a better job of that appraisal work so that the taxpayers are indeed being paid for every quarter wood that's being removed.
I'm familiar. My son-in-law was an appraiser for a lumber company up my way.
Oh, sure.
Mr. Chair, sorry. That is a concern. Sweetheart deals, how do you get around that stuff?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's been done.
Well, this bill doesn't require that they hire outside appraisers. What it does require, what they would normally use, and I think almost unilaterally use, is their own DNR forces to appraise the wood, and that, except that there was something that wasn't right about the relationship, we wouldn't have, as you described, a sweetheart deal. We have our DNR employees would be looking out for the interests of our natural resources in our state. I guess that's my feeling about that question. I think Mr. Tomlinson wants to add something.
Mr. Chair and President Purcell, I want to emphasize that this is the way we appraise wood, account for the volume of wood coming off, not necessarily what's paid for it. The wood would still be auctioned off and bid out, you know, to the highest bidder, that sort of a thing. But it's all relative to the volume that is being removed and how we account for that on a regular basis. So we do have a higher set of standards for selling as appraised volume than we do on the consumer approach. And we would expect that higher standard would be met by our appraisers. We're not looking at, I didn't catch it, that we're not looking to bid out any of the appraisal work necessarily. That would be work that would be done by our forestry folks. On the other hand, and it would be a fair amount of check cruising that would have to be done to make sure that we're working within that standard.
Mr. Chair, I think a pilot project is reasonable. I'm maybe more skeptical than others that we're going to come out of this, but I'll be interested to follow it.
Very good. Anyone from the public wants to testify for again? The musky guys here?
Musky guys. I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair, for 1132 as amended. The Environment Policy Committee, Representative Eakin.
Representative Dill renewed his motion that House File 1132 as amended be recommended pass. We refer to the Committee on Environment Policy and Oversight. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion prevails. Bill's adopted.
Thank you.
And we're going to adjourn. Next meeting is March 30th. Adjourn.